very good afternoon to you. The time is 12:07, and this is Midday Matters on 89.1 FM. I'm your host, Sean Beter. Very glad to be with you on this Monday, the very first day of October 2012. And joining me in the shotgun seat, if you will, it's Bob Kaler, once again from the Fort Wayne News Sentinel. Bob, thanks very much for coming in today.
Saying that I'm fully loaded would give the wrong impression, right? So I'll just say, happy to be here.
It may, yes. Thank you. We have a very good show for you today, and of course, we do want to hear from you. If you have a question or comment for our panelists, do give us a call. The number is 260-452-1185. Email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or you can always send us a tweet. It's @MiddayMatters. Joining us in studio for the hour is Tony Hudson. He's executive director of Blue Jacket. Tony, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
We also have Judge John Serbeck. Judge, thank you very much for being in studio today.
Thank you as well for having me.
And of course, over the course of this hour, we're going to talk about reentry programs. And Judge Serbeck, I wanted to start with you on this. Can you give us kind of a history of reentry in Indiana? Because really, you were kind of a spearhead in getting this program going.
In 2000, I was approached by a member of the Justice Department, United States Justice Department, who was originally a Fort Wayne native, as well as Sheila Hudson, who is the Director of Community Corrections. Those two had been asked by our new mayor at the time, Graham Richard, for some kind of programming to address crime. And their proposal was that returning offenders, folks returning from the Department of Correction after a period of incarceration in a penitentiary setting, were a very high-risk group. They were an identifiable group. And that with some programming as well as some supervision, we could reduce the recidivism rate of those folks. Those folks had tended to, both in Fort Wayne and nationally, been back in the penitentiary, 66% of them within 3 years.
Wow.
So we spent about a year and a half creating the program, designing the program, working with as many local agencies as we could, to create a program, and beginning in July of 2001, we began seeing most of the folks who come out of the Department of Correction and back into this community. They're supervised by Community Corrections for a period of time. They're on electronic monitoring for purposes of supervision. And as well, we provide them with a number of different programming opportunities, substance abuse type things, behavior modification type of programming, and as well jobs. At the time, Tony worked for Community Corrections, and we asked Tony to create a jobs program. No easy task, and I've joked about that from time to time ever since, but Tony picked it up and ran with that ball very, very effectively. He can give you the date, but sometime shortly after we began in 2001, the determination was made that his work could be more effective in a freestanding not-for-profit agency, and as a result, he created, with some assistance throughout the county, we had a great deal of cooperation throughout the county in creating Blue Jacket. Tony created Blue Jacket as a freestanding not-for-profit.
And you brought up a whole lot of points I want to get back to in a moment. But Tony Hudson, can you tell us a little more then about the founding of Blue Jacket, so the mission of Blue Jacket?
Well, Blue Jacket was created, as Judge Serbeck just mentioned, as a byproduct of the Allen County Reentry Court Initiative. And I give a lot of credit to the judge when he turned to me and he said, let's go make the impossible possible. And here we are trying to sell people with felony convictions to employers. And we knew that the traditional workforce system is really set up very well across the country and across the state. And our local Work One works very well. However, the myriad of social issues that men and women coming home from prison and the need for redemption and the rebuilding of trust is very difficult to regain in a workshop or a work setting. A workshop setting. And so creating an employment program in-house under the guise of Allen County Community Corrections, where I was employed, was working. It was working very well. A lot of people were getting jobs, but then word got out and hundreds, if not thousands, of people were asking us to serve them around the county and surrounding counties. But we couldn't under the guise of Allen County Community Corrections. So here's someone who's been out of prison for 10 years, clamoring for assistance, needing with perhaps no work experience and a lengthy criminal history, and we couldn't serve them. So one of the main reasons why the 501c3 Blue Jacket was incorporated was to serve those number of people that needed assistance, as well as those in the criminal justice setting.
Now, does Blue Jacket serve only those with felony convictions? Are there others that the program serves as well?
For the last 7 years, we've served people. 99.9% have felony convictions, and we've served anyone from a very high grade A felony to low grade D felonies. Lower grade, I guess I should say. Every felony is high in many people's eyes. But we've served a few people with misdemeanor offenses. And recently we just opened up to partner with other nonprofits that have other hard-to-employ populations, homelessness issues, chronically low-income poverty situations as well, to provide our workforce training that we've seemed to work on since 2000 and what was it, Judge? 2002, when we launched our initiative shortly after the reentry court. Began, and when Blue Jacket Incorporated, they acquired that training from the county.
How many folks do you believe Blue Jacket has served since its inception? You mentioned hundreds, if not thousands, mm-hmm. of people contacting you. How many people have successfully completed the program?
We have graduated, I believe, 2,600 people.
Wow.
Since we launched in 2005.
Wow.
So we incorporated in 2003, shortly after, 2 years after the Reentry Court Initiative began.
Sounds right.
And then it took us a few years to procure some grants to launch Blue Jacket officially.
We do want to hear from you, our listeners, today. If you have a question or comment for Tony Hudson or Judge John Serbeck, do give us a call. The number is 260-452-1185. Email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or you can always send us a tweet. That's @MiddayMatters. We do want to hear from you today. Judge John Serbeck, I mean, I think some people would wonder, you know, why do we need a program like this, like Blue Jacket? Why do we need reentry programs in the first place? Can't these folks, you know, get out and do it on their own?
The simple answer to that is no, they can't. These are folks, in all due respect, these are folks that have proven that on their own, their judgment isn't always very good. And many of the people that I see, even in serious felony cases, as Tony noted, are people who are there because of bad decisions, bad judgment. They aren't necessarily bad people. I see some bad people as well. But many of the people that we see, many of the people that we send to the penitentiary and come back from the penitentiary, are really not bad people. They just have used poor judgment and need a little assistance in redirecting them, if you will.
Redirecting them, just in the jobs placement, sector, or in other areas as well.
Overall, as I say, our biggest problem continues to be housing. But that aside, our programming includes substance abuse counseling, includes cognitive behavioral modification type of programming, decision making, life skills, all those kinds of things that a lot of us take for granted, but yet these folks have missed it somewhere along the way. They didn't have the family. They didn't have the privilege of having family that most of us had to guide us well. In fact, that's kind of the way I got into this whole project in the first place. I was about 12 years into my career and was getting very frustrated that the folks I was seeing third generations of the same families. I was a public defender for 16 years, and I represented the first generation. The second generation I either represented before I became a judge or after I became a judge was sentencing them, and by 12 years in, I'm sentencing the third generation of the same families over and over again. It was kind of frustrating because I felt like I was doing what I was supposed to do, and it didn't seem to be making a difference.
Bob Kaler.
A question for either one of you. What part of the obstacle to felons getting jobs is stigmatization, and what part is deficiencies in their own preparation or character when they're released?
I can't quantify that, but obviously the stigmatization is significant. And our legislature has finally begun addressing those kinds of things. They haven't stepped very far out, but it's time that at some point some people need to be able to outlive their convictions. And that's a controversial issue. You don't want to get rid of it too quickly because everybody else has a right to know that these people did something wrong in the past, and therefore there may be some reason to believe that that may happen again. But the farther you get from that conduct, the less likely that stereotype applies, and maybe at some point, at some time after the conviction, it is time to put it to rest and put it away.
When you're looking at a dossier or file on a felon, what are the things that you see about what he or she did while they're in prison that give you the most hope, make you think this person is likely to be a good prospect?
When it comes to, pardon me, I'd also like to be able to respond, Bob, to the stigmatization.
Okay.
And myself being an employer as well, I understand that I'm going to do a criminal background on every one of my employees. However, a third of my staff are Blue Jacket graduates, and so a felony record matters very little to me. But I understand that an employer is in business to make money, and if there's a liability to hire someone off the street or through an agency that may create some risk, and the risk to loss of customer base or inventory, I understand their need to bring to light their criminal background, because past behavior predicts future behavior. And I understand that employers have that right. 92% of employers nowadays, according to the Human Resource Council, National Human Resource Council, 92% of employers do criminal background checks now. And I think that warrants a lot of great conversations to be had with people who have felony convictions. And I guess to go back to your most immediate question, I see the deficit in the ability, and how does, you know, staying active in prison help with their gainful employment? Trust takes time and it takes effort. And an employer is going to say, well, why should I give you a second chance if you've done very little in prison, you've done very little when you've come home, and how are you going to be able to prove to me that you're serious about this second chance? Because employers are used to a lot of lip service, not only from a walk-in off of the street who has no criminal background. Can I do what I say I can do? And then when there's someone who has been in prison, been very active, taking on jobs and taking on responsibilities and taking on things that many other people wouldn't on idle time, says a lot about their character, says a lot about their interest in getting that second chance.
We're going to take a quick break, but we will return to this conversation with Tony Hudson and Judge John Serbeck in just a moment. And of course, we want to hear from you today. If you or perhaps somebody you know has been affected by reentry programs, including Blue Jacket, we want to hear your story. Or if you just have a question or comment, the number is 260-452-1185. Email middaymatters at nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or you can always send us a tweet. It's at middaymatters. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, Waging Heavy Peace, singer Neil Young has a new memoir about his life on stage and off. Join us.
Fresh Air, weekdays at 1 on WBOI.
American Roots is Alabama bound. As we explore the music and culture of the Deep South state, that produce musicians as diverse as W.C. Handy, Hank Williams, and the Drive-By Truckers. Find out how stars fell in Alabama and visit Muscle Shoals, birthplace of Southern Soul. I'm Nick Spitzer. We're Alabama bound on American Roots from PRX.
Monday night at 7 on WBOI.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Indiana Tech Law School, opening in Fort Wayne in fall 2013. Information on admissions and curriculum at www.indianatech.edu/law or 855-TECH-LAW. Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Reinbold and Anderson, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC, local financial advisors who help people just like you. More information at Reinbold and Anderson on NIPR's homepage at www.nipr.fm.
Here at 89.1 FM, you're tuned to Midday Matters. I'm your host, Sean Beter. Very glad to be with you on this Monday afternoon. Bob Kaler from the Fort Wayne News Sentinel is in the studio as well. And during this hour, we're talking about reentry programs for those leaving incarceration. We do want to hear from you today. Do give us a call. The number, it's 260-452-1185. Email middaymatters at nipr.fm. Post on our Facebook wall. You can always send us a tweet as well. That's at Midday Matters. Joining us in studio today, it's Judge John Serbeck and Tony Hudson, who's the executive director of Blue Jacket Inc. I want to get back to a point that we sort of touched on in the first part of the program, but Tony Hudson, we'll start with you. Certainly in getting a lot of folks placed back into the workforce, placed back into daily life even, those folks face some pretty significant challenges. I imagine, though, that getting employers on board and cooperating and maybe a little less nervous is a big challenge, too, though.
It is. It has always been a challenge to get employers on board, and I see programs like ours around the country battling the issue of having one poor placement create enough resentment from an employer that, hey, I gave that ex-con or that ex-felon or that ex-offender a chance, and they burn me. I'm never going to hire another criminal again. Hmm. And we hear those words in the stigma, reverting back to the original question. We hear those words, and I feel sorry for those employers because they miss out on some incredible opportunities. And so, yeah, it's difficult. And we've really worked hard the last 5 years. And in fact, when we first launched Blue Jacket, I'm not sure if Judge Serbeck remembers this or not, but when we first launched Blue Jacket, we engaged IPFW MBA students to assess a feasibility of us having our own in-house staffing agency to help lower the risk of placement of these men and women to employers so that we carry the burden of their workers' comp and the payroll taxes and the federal and state taxes and drug screening. And we place them just like any other labor agency. And so employers are starting to say, hey, I really like this deal. It's a kind of a try before you buy opportunity. But it's almost to the contrary. We deal with employers that want really, really cheap labor, and they may be manufacturing widgets, and they call Blue Jacket because they think, oh, well, here's someone who I can pay $6-7 an hour and get away with it. And we're like, no, our product is pretty dang good. And the people we have vetted through our 1 month long program, we are going to expect that you're going to pay the same markup you would, or even better, than any other staffing agencies that we compete with. So yeah, one of those barriers is a mindset from an employer that they can get really cheap entry level work.
What's the pitch that you make when you approach an employer or an employer approaches you?
Well, an employer is going to find out that we have a four-week training called our Career Academy, and this is the byproduct of the training we had in-house under the Allen County government. Recognizing that 100% of our individuals have committed or violated a public law that trust matters. And so how are you going to regain that through a workshop setting? We've done this 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for 4 weeks in a row. We've had these men and women in a co-educational classroom setting show up dressed business professional on time with their assignments complete every single day. And if they're a minute late or have one line on their assignment that has not been complete, that says to us, well, maybe you're not ready for employment quite yet. They're allowed to reapply through our program, but that vets someone who's very motivated and interested in gaining that second chance through hard work. Our program is not easy. So we go to an employer and we say, yes, here's someone who really wants to gain that second chance. It's not easy to go through Blue Jacket. Therefore, we know these individuals. We've been around them for 60 to 80 hours of projects that they've been giving back to the community, projects in-house, projects with other nonprofits and churches, and we see their work ethic. It's not just how well do they do in a workshop setting. How well do they do out there with hands-on projects as a manager, as a team player? So the vetting process of their job readiness is really good. Employers like that.
Bob Kaler.
So from what you've described, Tony, you could people who graduate from Blue Jackets training, you can take that to an employer as a way of signifying that this person has a handle on punctuality and attendance. This person can follow instructions. What else can you bring to that list of qualifications just based on a person going through the training program?
We realize that this is not a fail-safe program, and we made people very good job seekers because our training is very good. And you have to realize that we're serving a fifth grade reading level, an average between someone who's never gone to even grade school to someone who graduated with a PhD, an MD, a CPA. We have really high-level individuals and high-profile individuals that commit crimes, and so there's no socioeconomic boundary. Our training is good. Our classroom setting is good. But what we did not do is vet how ready they are for the job. And so in addition to that, we can say, hey, they've not only appearing on time and adapting to our workplace dress code and our guidelines and our expectations, but they found transportation every single day for those that do not have driver's licenses. And we audited about 75% of our clients do not have their licenses back yet. Sometimes that's related to their charge, not to any traffic violation, but it's related to their charge. And Judge Serbeck in the Rancho Court, they do very well with mediating and mitigating some of those circumstances for the men and women who have the hardship to employment with transportation. So they were there.
Well, Judge Serbeck, let me pass it to you then. I mean, what is your role once somebody has, say, entered a reentry program, started working with Blue Jacket? Where do you re-step into the process here?
Yes. And maybe I need to step back a step or two to explain a little further. We run reentry court on the same basis, same protocol as drug court. Drug court was established, I think, originally in the early 90s in Dade County, Florida. And they found that having a judge involved directly, one-on-one with the offenders, so to speak, as opposed to some kind of buffer of a probation officer, a parole officer, whoever, a police officer, whatever, It was far more effective to have a judge dealing directly on a pretty immediate basis, as opposed to any, you know, the scenarios you might imagine.
Well, such as?
With others. That somebody commits some violation, they get picked up on a probation violation, put in jail, and it's a month or 6 weeks before I see them, as opposed to having some kind of a violation. And our case manager will bring them into our court within at the next court session within a week. So they're confronted almost immediately with issues. They may be minor issues. They may be major issues. As Tony mentioned to you, one of the significant things that as judge, I never really appreciated, I never thought I could expect, perhaps, of offenders, that they had to be someplace right on time. Community Corrections has always had a real strong sense about that, that folks need to be where they're supposed to be when they're supposed to be there. Not 5 minutes late or 10 minutes late. 5 or 10 minutes is significant. I never thought that until I started putting it in Tony's job context that it's no wonder these people can't keep a job because they don't, you know, being someplace within a half hour, an hour of when they were supposed to be is good enough. Hmm. And, of course, it's not for job people.
It sounds to me almost like, and I've certainly read other things about, you know, drug court programs, similar programs. It sounds to me, though, almost like you're creating a stronger relationship maybe between either judge and offender or even the system and the offender than they might otherwise get.
They seem to respect and appreciate the fact that the judge, whether it be me in reentry court, Judge Gall in drug court, Judge Davis in her Hope probation program, they seem to appreciate that one-on-one as opposed to having some other buffer, whether it's a probation officer or their lawyer or whatever, and they take it more seriously. I just had an opportunity not very long ago. We're certified. The reentry court is certified by the Indiana Judicial Center as a problem-solving court. And the certification team was up here about a month ago. And one of those folks shared with me, he did an exit interview with a group of our folks. And he said, you know, something you ought to know is that these people without exception all say to me, we really appreciate talking to the judge. And we really appreciate it when the judge tells us we've done something well. So that seems to mean something. And that's like I say, that's what they learned very early on. That's one of the fundamentals of drug court and that drug court protocol. We use that protocol. We don't necessarily do the same things as drug court, but we use that process that they use.
260-452-1185 is the number to call if you'd like to join in the conversation today, and we do invite you to do that. You can also email us, middaymatters@nipr.fm, a post on our Facebook wall, that's facebook.com/middaymatters, or send us a tweet. Tony Hudson, just a few minutes before we have to go to break here, but do you see that relationship in the folks that you work with? Does that one-to-one relationship early on in the process make a difference?
With the judge, do you mean?
Yeah, with the judge.
I think it matters a great deal. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you were if anyone ever went to the Reentry Court Initiative, when he's holding court on Friday mornings or something, I see men and women walk out of that courtroom and they are in awe because of the way that he is fair, he's judicious, and he is he holds every male and female accountable to their own life trajectory. So how intrinsically motivated are you to do what is right, to change your life circumstances? And you see family members and children, and there's just a lot of people that walk away with a great respect for Judge Serbeck, and I know they do for Judge Davis and Judge Gold as well.
Bob, do you think it's as simple as some of these people have never gotten a pat on the back from an important authority figure, mm-hmm. like the likes of a judge?
Right. I see so many attaboys from Judge Serbeck from the bench that just that small bit of positive reinforcement goes a very long way. I'm impressed.
We're going to take a quick break here for the news. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation with Tony Hudson and Judge John Serbeck. Bob Kaler is here as well for the hour, and we want you to be a part of the conversation. Once again, that number, 260-452-1185, or you can call us toll-free if you like. That's 1-800-471-9264. Stay with us. This is Midday Matters.
Both presidential candidates agree the tax code is overly complex, but solving the puzzle is hard, and talking about solutions can be worse.
We, the public as voters, really penalize the candidates when they start identifying who's going to pay for government.
We launch our new series, Solve This, pulling apart tax policy on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
That's weekdays starting at 4 on WBOI Northeast Indiana Public Radio. Good afternoon. You're listening to Northeast Indiana Public Radio. I'm Sarah DeLeo with WBOI News. Family and friends of two 19-year-olds fatally shot at a Fort Wayne home last year are trying to raise enough money to demolish it and turn it into a memorial garden. The home is for sale for $32,000. Police say Erin Yale brought along a friend, 19-year-old Ryan Tipton, when she went to her former boyfriend's house in December to retrieve some belongings. Police said her ex-boyfriend, 43-year-old Bart Heller, shot them both, then killed himself. Tipton's father says the memorial garden would provide a way to bring some good out of the tragedy. Yale's mother says if they can't raise enough money to buy the house, they would use the money to start a foundation for people grieving victims of violence. Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke is visiting the Hoosier State to speak before the Economic Club of Indiana. A crowd of about 2,000 people is expected at today's luncheon at the Indiana Convention Center for Bernanke's speech, which is being watched as it comes in the midst of the presidential campaign. Many Republicans have been critical of the Fed's continued efforts to drive interest rates lower, saying they fear it could ignite inflation. But Bernanke has maintained the Fed makes its decisions based entirely on the state of the economy. Bernanke was first appointed to lead the Federal Reserve in 2006 by President George W. Bush. He was reappointed in 2010 by President Barack Obama. A review of 10,000 online pharmacies shows fewer than 3% comply with federal and state laws. That's according to the National Association of Boards of Pharmacy. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports, the Food and Drug Administration is trying to educate the public on how to spot a fake online pharmacy.
Many unlicensed online pharmacies originate in foreign countries, making it tougher for U.S. authorities to shut them down. FDA Office of Compliance Director Elisa Bernstein says buying medication from fraudulent pharmacies can be incredibly dangerous, even if those drugs are cheaper.
They think that they're getting the real thing, but in fact, what they get are fake, expired, contaminated, and otherwise unsafe drugs.
Because shutting down the fake online pharmacies is difficult, Bernstein says consumers need to be aware of the warning signs.
A fraudulent online pharmacy will let you buy a medicine without a prescription, offer cheap or discount prices, send spam, and be located outside the U.S. Those are red flags.
Bernstein says safe online pharmacies require prescriptions, are licensed and located in the United States, and have a licensed pharmacist available to answer questions. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith.
Recent debate over problems at the state's Department of Child Services has largely left out discussion of money, but it's a pressing concern for grandparents, foster parents, and community health providers. Many of those people told lawmakers last week that they were frustrated by difficulty in getting the state to pay for care of their children. DCS spokeswoman Stephanie McFarland says cuts made during the recession did not affect reimbursement rates for child care providers and notes that some money was restored this year. DCS has been the focus of questions about its centralized hotline for reporting abuse and neglect, and the agency was rocked by last week's resignation of Director James Payne after an Indianapolis Star investigation raised questions about his involvement in a DCS case involving his grandchildren. Taking a quick look at the WBOY weather forecast, today we can expect partly sunny skies with a high near 67 degrees. Tonight, showers are likely later on into the evening. We'll have mostly cloudy skies with a low around 53. Tomorrow, Tuesday, a 50% chance of showers, cloudy skies with a high near 67. And now back to your host for Midday Matters, Sean Beter.
About 20 minutes before the top of the hour, 1 o'clock, this is Midday Matters on 89.1 FM. I'm your host, Sean Beter. Very glad to be with you on this first day of October. Joining me in studio, of course, the usual suspect himself, Bob Kaler from the Fort Wayne News Sentinel. And today we're talking about reentry programs for those leaving incarceration. We're talking with Tony Hudson, Executive Director of Blue Jacket, Inc., and Judge John Serbeck. Bob Kaler.
I'd like to know what both of you can tell us about the impact of this on recidivism.
Since we began the program in 2001, we have very carefully evaluated results. We've done an evaluation every 2 years. As I said to you all during the break, I have a bad habit when I sit down trying to read those reports carefully. I tend to glaze over pretty quickly. But in the meantime, we are reducing recidivism by about a third. National numbers are still well into the 60%, and we're in the 40% of folks committing new crimes going back to jail within 3 years.
And this was from a recidivism rate you mentioned earlier of, about two-thirds of folks come back in the door?
The numbers when we began in 2000, 2001 were 66%. 66% could be expected to recidivate within 3 years. That number nationally has come down a little bit, but not much. But in the meantime, we remain in the 40s, even considering a 10-year span on the population.
Wow. And Tony Hudson, we were talking a little over the break here too. You also have a set of recidivism numbers. They're a little different, though.
Right, they are. We serve people that are not from the Reentry Court Initiative as well. A lot of walk-ins, a lot of people from other counties drive to our site every day, and so we, in fact, have to fundraise to be able to serve them. And so we gauge employment rates as well as recidivism rates. Our recidivism rate, we combine rearrest as well as reincarceration, but to be able to provide your listeners with an apples-to-apples comparison, the Department of Correction has a recidivism rate of its returning inmates of 38, 37, and 36% the last 3 years consecutively. And our return to prison within our recidivism stat is like 18, 18, and 9%. Not in the right order, but it's it was 18, 9, and 18% the last 3 years. So it dipped before the housing market, and so 2011 is still out, and our employment rate is 60% of our graduates are employed within 3 months of graduating our training, and so usually the people who are referred to us and who are walk-ins are the hardest to employ when it comes to someone who has a felony conviction. If they have a good network and they're marketable, they'll find a job on their own. So we're serving those who do not have a good network and are not marketable.
Tony, my understanding is this group tends to be employed on only like a 10 or 20% basis without assistance from someone like you.
You're right.
Wow.
You're right. Thanks for the comparison, Judge.
I do want to invite our listeners to join the conversation as well. Give us a call and join us today. The number is 260-452-1185. Email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or you can always send us a tweet and we'll do our best to get your question or comment on the air. Bob.
So what have been the top types of businesses for employing people through Blue Jacket?
As of late, it's been light industrial. We serve a lot of the manufacturing world as well. We have some construction, some office environments as well. We have sales representatives that we've placed, and it really spreads the gamut on what type of industries we place in. A lot of people in the service world, but largely it's light industrial. That's the majority of our placements that we make in relationships we have with employers.
I'm curious, how many employers do you have participating in the program now?
Oh my gosh, we have so many small mom and pop employers that are willing to give a second chance, that their hiring is only occasional, so we put them on the back burner. It makes it almost looks like our list is inflated. So we have about 100 employers right now that are actively using us for placements, which is good. It there's an ebb and flow to that as well.
How can employers, if they're interested, get in touch with you to show their interest?
Well, thank you. Our website is bluejacketinc.org, and on our Blue Jacket Inc. www.jobs.org page. We have a job posting page. I mean, they can post jobs with us. It largely goes through our staffing coordinator. Her name is Michelle Minton, and all of our contact information is on this brand spanking new website. It looks really nice.
And we'll put a link to that website on our Facebook page after the program is through. Hearing those numbers, your recidivism rates, the employment rates, and this is a question for both of you. Judge, perhaps we'll start with you. How do you mark success in this program? Is it getting everybody employed and out into the workforce? Is it not seeing as many families as you mentioned at the top of the program through the door? What does success in reentry court mean to you?
Success in reentry is not committing another offense.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of our folks are way beyond that. They're being employed on a regular basis. They're paying their child support. They've gotten their driver's licenses back. They're going to work every day. All those kinds of regular responsible things that for so long we've all said, oh, people that go to jail can't do those things. Well, they can. Hmm. They need a little help sometimes, but they can do that.
Is there a benchmark that you're shooting for recidivism rates to be able to call this, to point to this and say, yes, this is, you know, we did our job in getting this program going?
Simple answer to that is no. I don't work for statistics. It's absolutely necessary to evaluate what you have done. But in the meantime, we focus on substance in programming and see how that programming plays out in statistics after the fact. You need to keep track of that. You need to evaluate. But I don't focus on numbers.
Tony Hudson, I'll ask you the same question. I mean, how do you know when you're successful with a Blue Jacket, somebody who enters a Blue Jacket program?
I'm going to respond to the reentry court as well as Blue Jacket, if you don't mind, Judge. people come to the reentry court initiative, returning home from prison, and that intersection in time does not mean that they are ready to change their life trajectory. It doesn't mean that they have that motivation to do what is right or wrong, but just to change their circumstance. And being that the judge is giving a lot of great tools and a lot of great opportunities for people with his network of partnerships from Park Center to Island County Community Corrections and Parole, that and among other partnerships, that they are ready to change. And so to gauge your performance and outcomes, I think, is very important. And of course, with Blue Jacket, going on to Blue Jacket, our outcomes and performance mean when someone's employed, it means they're less likely to commit new crimes. But success comes in so many different ways. I mean, look at the reentry court. Someone who is no longer using drugs, but may not be very marketable to an employer right now, and is not using drugs for 1 year, is incredible success. And I mean, if they get their children back, if they are able to stay on their own, maybe through a halfway house setting or just rent their own apartment, that's success. That means that's someone who's not draining our public assistance and our governmental system, that this is someone who's striving to become a little bit more self-sufficient. And the same thing goes for Blue Jacket. We're restoring confidence and hope, and we're helping people become redeemable again. It's not just redeemed, because the burden to forgive someone is on the employer and on the family and on the community. The burden lays on us to be able to forgive that person for their past and their criminal conviction. The burden to regain that trust is on the client, is on the ex-offender. And so we call it redeemable. And so when someone hits that redeemable phase, we know that it's very successful for us.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll finish the conversation when we get back. But we do want to hear from you today. If you have a question or a comment, perhaps your life has been affected by these programs, give us a call. It's 260-452-1185. Post on our Facebook wall, send us a tweet, or you can always email us. It's middaymatters@nipr.fm. Stay with us. We'll finish the conversation when we get back.
On the next Fresh Air, Waging Heavy Peace, Singer Neil Young has a new memoir about his life on stage and off. Join us.
Fresh Air, weekdays at 1 on WBOI.
The Syrian army blanketed rebel fighters with a text message on Thursday, "Game over." They might well have replied, "Wishful thinking." The civil war's already dragged on for 18 months, killed tens of thousands, and forced even more to flee to neighboring countries. I'm Neil Conan, the Civil War in Syria, plus our weekly read of the Opinion Page. Join us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Tune in weekdays at 2 here on WBOI, Northeast Indiana Public Radio.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Lutheran Hospital, providing procedures for heart failure patients that keep their treatment in Fort Wayne close to home. Information at lutheranhealth.net.
Seven minutes before 1 o'clock here at 89.1 FM. I'm Sean Beter, along with Bob Kaler from the Fort Wayne News Sentinel. And on today's program, we're talking about reentry programs for those leaving incarceration. We're also talking about the Blue Jacket program with Tony Hudson. He's the executive director of Blue Jacket, and Judge John Serbeck. And we do want you to join the conversation today, so give us a call. The number 260-452-1185. Email middaymatters@nipr.fm, post on our Facebook wall, or you can always send us a tweet. It's at Midday Matters. Let's go to the phones here. We've got Bill on the line. Bill, good afternoon. You're on Midday Matters.
Good afternoon.
You're on the program. Go ahead, please.
Yes, I've been listening to the program, and I have a family member who has who's experienced felonies. And I can appreciate what Tony said. I don't know whether he is quite at the stage to be redeemable in his own mind, but I think he's still trying to change the circumstances to some extent. He has had some success in networking and job. Do you have people who come and at least, you know, take a look at the program or talk to somebody or maybe refer to somebody who's gone through it who could tell them about the benefits that maybe might open their mind a little more?
In fact, we do. We have a number of graduates that come back and provide their testimonials. And every Tuesday at noon, if your relative would call Blue Jacket at 744-1900, he'd find out about our orientation. And that is when we have employers and graduates come back, and we kind of lay it out. Here are our expectations. They're pretty intense, but here are the benefits of our program. And so it may benefit him to give us a call.
And that number one more time, Tony. Sorry there, Bill.
Sorry. It is 744-1900.
And that's on Tuesdays?
Every Tuesday at noon. But have him call so we know to expect him. And he'll find out how to enroll, how to apply for scholarships, and then attend the training.
Thank you, Tony. Appreciate it.
Thanks for calling.
Bill, thanks very much for your call. We do appreciate it. Still about 5 minutes left in the program here. If you would like to join the conversation, the number 260-452-1185. And Bob Kaler, you were about to jump in before we went to break.
Oh. And I have lost track.
Didn't mean to catch you.
You did catch me without notes written in front of me. Okay.
I wanted to pop in here just briefly. I mean, Tony, do you get a lot of calls like that? You mentioned at the outset of the program you were there was a deluge of people corresponding with you. Has that continued?
It does. Yeah, we've recently moved into a larger building and received a considerable amount of media attention, and so there have been a lot of calls. I'd say every Tuesday we have 20, 25 people sitting down in our classroom. orientation. Half of those most likely were referred from the reentry court or other criminal justice agencies. The other half are walk-ins, hearing about us word of mouth. And so we like that people are interested in gaining that second chance.
Bob got his train of thought
back. It came
back
to me. Yeah. have either of you had conversations with the Department of Correction about what they do or what they could do differently to help prepare felons to reenter society? Or have they come to you picking your brains about what they could learn from your experiences?
We have had since we began designing the program, we have had an extraordinary relationship with the DOC. I can call down there and get significant personnel on the phone almost immediately to help with problems. And while neither of us have totally changed what we do or how we do it, we have had an excellent exchange back and forth. They've modified some of their practices. We've modified some of our practices. It's a tremendous work in progress, and we have been treated very, very respectfully in spite of when people imagine dealing with huge agencies as the Department of Corrections is. I think I'm told it's the largest agency in the state. I can call and get somebody significant on the phone almost immediately, and vice versa. They're not reluctant. I've got emails, cell phones, all those things back and forth, and we have continuing good communication.
Have you seen impact from those conversations in how they run prisons?
I don't know. It's the way they run prisons, or rather, they have made process changes for us. Okay. As we have for them. I don't know that we've truly impacted their substance, but that's not my job.
just about a minute left in the program here. I wanted to jump in and ask Tony. I mean, you mentioned the new building. Mm-hmm. You mentioned a lot of growth. Do you expect the growth to continue? Is it sustainable?
I do expect the growth to continue, and is any nonprofit sustainable? I think they are. I mean, there are a lot of people out there wanting to become more employable, and I think we have the catalyst to make that happen. So we're excited about what the future entails. I mean, moving away from our federal Department of Labor grant last June changed a lot of things, but we believe that our new funding mechanisms are going to take us into another century of work.
Tony has, let me offer one other thing, one last thing on Tony's behalf, and that is he's just commenced a training program for other counties where he will train their trainers, so to speak, to take this program out into other counties.
Well, we're going to have to leave the conversation there, but we'll put a link up to the Blue Jacket website on our own Facebook page. That's facebook.com/MiddayMatters. Tony Hudson, Judge John Serbeck, thank you both very much for being with us for Midday Matters today.
Thanks for having us.
Bob Kaler, thank you as well.
Thanks.
I'm Sean Beter, and this is Northeast Indiana Public Radio, WBOI, Fort Wayne. The time is 1:00. Have a very good day.